Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Advanced Prostanoid Therapy in PAH, The Time to be Proactive is Now, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Aaron B. Waxman, MD, PhD, Murali M. Chakanala, MD, and Robert P. Franz, MD. Dr. Waxman is a director, Pulmonary Vascular Disease Program, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard Medical School, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Waxman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Pfizer and United Therapeutics Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from Gilead Sciences. Dr. Waxman does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Waxman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Chakanala is an associate professor of medicine, pulmonary and critical care medicine, Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Chakanala has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Actelion Pharmaceuticals, Gilead Sciences, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and United Therapeutics Corporation. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Actelion Pharmaceuticals, Gilead Sciences, and United Therapeutics Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from Actelion Pharmaceuticals, Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Eli Lilly and Company, Gilead Sciences, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and United Therapeutics Corporation. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. Dr. Chakanala does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Chakanala does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Franz is an associate professor of medicine, Mayo Medical School, Rochester, Minnesota, director, Pulmonary Hypertension Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Franz has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Pfizer and United Therapeutics Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from United Therapeutics Corporation. Dr. Franz does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Franz does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on the appropriate use of prostanoid therapy for the management of PAH. This activity is supported by United Therapeutics. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I am Aaron Waxman. I am the director of the Pulmonary Vascular Disease Program at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And today's program is entitled Advanced Prostanoid Therapy in PAH, The Time to be Proactive is Now. And I am joined by two good friends and colleagues today. On my right is Bob Franz, who is the associate professor and director of the Mayo Pulmonary Hypertension Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And to his right is Murali Chakanala, Associate Professor of Medicine in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. So what I think we ought to start with is, first, if Murali would give us a quick overview of the role of prostacyclines as far as the metabolic derangements, why we use them, and what other classes of drugs are available for PAH today.
Thanks, Aaron. Well, we're fortunate that we have now three classes of therapies for pulmonary hypertension. We have endothelin receptor antagonists, we have phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors, and we have the prostacyclines, or some of us call them advanced prostanoids. They're clearly different therapies, all efficacious. We don't have a lot of experience, direct experience, I should say, between the different therapies, but they function differently. I think what the other thing we've learned over the years is that because of their uniqueness and the differences in delivery systems, that some tend to be utilized more than others. And that the prostacyclines, which many of us feel have some of the most or the greatest potency against our disease and for our patients, are underutilized. And I think that's a complex issue that maybe we can explore a little bit further as we talk today.
So, Bob, if you could just touch on what is the current paradigm of prostacycline use.
Well, it's sort of ironic that we end up talking about the prostanoids last as we talk about therapies, because they're really the first therapy that was developed, and a therapy that was profoundly important when it was initially developed in terms of improving outcome for a disease that previously had had really no management. So as we think about endothelin antagonists, PDE5 inhibitors, and prostanoids, often it's so easy to start with an oral therapy, which would be a PDE5 inhibitor or an endothelin antagonist. And the concern is that often there's not a decision made ever to add a prostanoid. The prostanoids are really important in pulmonary hypertension. In the pathophysiology, we know that the prostanoid pathway is deficient in the lungs in patients with pulmonary hypertension. These agents have really pleiotropic effects in terms of their effect on cellular proliferation, some anti-inflammatory effects, antiplatelet effects. We don't really know for sure exactly which of those roles is important in humans with PH, but clearly they can have very potent effects in patients with pulmonary hypertension. So I think one thing we could all agree on is that if we have a class 4 patient, that patient is really best served with going with a continuous prostanoid therapy. And these patients who are class 4, there's an early mortality after they reach the physician that is very real. And these patients, you don't always know where they are in the curve, where they presented late in the disease course. And if there's any delay in therapy or therapy that's not adequately effective, they may well die in the coming weeks and months, to the point that the initial study of intravenous epoprostenol demonstrated a mortality benefit in just a few months. And so I think at least we could set the ground and say that I think we would agree that class 4 patients really ought to get a continuous prostanoid unless they absolutely refuse it or there's some other really mitigating circumstance.
So I think you bring up a great point. You know, one thing that's clear is that way too many people are dying, having never seen a prostacycline in this disease, where we think and know it's probably the most effective therapy. So when should prostanoids be first-line therapy? In some ways, oral therapy has actually inhibited a lot of people from going on what may be the best therapy. So when do you decide prostacycline should be first? And knowing that a functional class 4 is obviously going to get it first. But what about the other classes?
I think Bob touched on it a little bit there, Aaron. I mean, I think we all know that really sick patient, the functional class 4 patient who can't do anything without being extremely symptomatic, the patient who's on the verge of passing out or pre-syncope or even syncopizing with daily activities. I don't think there's any question that that kind of patient we're going to be emphasizing or targeting prostacycline therapy from the get-go. I think where we run into some trouble is the lesser sick patient, where the lure of using a simpler therapy can be compelling for both the physician and the patient. And in my practice, I've always tried to individualize the treatment to the patient, and it's not the same for every patient. There's clearly disease-related parameters, and we know of various markers that have been shown in study after study, including hemodynamics like the right atrial pressure. We know that the higher the functional class, especially the 3B and the 4 patients, the sicker they are, the shorter 6-minute walk distances. So we put all those think disease-specific characteristics into the conversation. But then we also have to establish or look at demographics, the support that patients have for complex therapies. And then I think the big one that patients often don't appreciate is what are our long-term goals here. And those goals are very different when you're talking about a 20-year-old young mother or parent and a 70-year-old who's lived a long life and just wants to be able to, you know, maximize her time and feel better than what she is. So I think you have to look at all those things. And when you do that, you realize that sometimes even the less sick patients, that functional class 3 patient who has some worrisome disease characteristics, who's got a very long horizon, and who's got, you know, plenty of support in the intellect to do advanced prostanoid therapy, that we shouldn't put it off in that patient. We should bring it to the table much sooner.
I think we have to talk about this functional class thing in some detail, because it's been sort of a backbone of how we've risk stratified patients traditionally. And we can all agree on the class 4 patients for the most part, and maybe the class 1, 2s. The class 3s are a big group of our patients, and there's sick class 3 and not so sick class 3. And I think in that setting especially, we tend to turn to other markers of natriuretic peptides. For example, brain natriuretic peptide is a marker of disease severity. We know from the REVEAL registry that an N-terminal BNP level greater than 1,500 predicted a poor one-year outcome, or a BNP level greater than about 150 or so. And so these biomarkers can help us say, is this a patient whose right ventricle is getting into trouble, which often drives outcome, or is this a less sick class 3 patient? We also use other parameters such as 6-minute walk distance and other parameters of right ventricular function and echocardiography and hemodynamics. But in general, we talk about a goal of trying to get the patients back to a functional class 2 if the only thing we're thinking about is functional class. And I think we see that because if you look at any of the outcome data, we see these curves where you can see a clear divergence between those patients who stay class 3 or class 4 despite therapy and those who move back to a class 1, 2. And sometimes we think about what are the barriers to using prostanoids in these patients who are still class 3. And part of it is patient-driven in the sense that sometimes the patients say, I feel pretty well, I can pretty much do what I want to do, why do you want to add this additional therapy? And so one thing that I wonder about is you've got that class 3 patient that you're worried about, or they say, I don't really want to do something differently. What do you look at to help you decide to treat a class 3 patient with a prostanoid, and how do you convince a patient that it's in their best interest?
I think the other consideration, I mean, we know the drugs work, but importantly, they're complicated therapies, that not every patient is going to be able to do the therapy, or their caregiver or family members may not be able to participate. So what things do you think about? You know, age, you mentioned the older patient versus the younger patient. Who should we be thinking about, not the earlier patient? So if this were a family member, when would you be thinking about starting them on a prostanoid?
You know, I think, again, I think when there are worrisome disease characteristics, I think we both touched on a couple of those things, particularly high right atrial pressure, evidence of heart failure on examination, even if they're not hospitalized per se, the patients who are becoming presyncopal with activities of daily living. Those are some of the characteristics that worry me. I also look a lot at the 6-minute walk and not just at the distance covered, but I also look at things like how difficult is it to do the walk in terms of the Borg score, how much their heart rate goes up. And if you have a young person who, yeah, they're functional class 3 and can do quite a bit, but they're really requiring a very fast heart rate just to do basic activities of daily living, that's a patient who, to me, their stroke volume is compromised and they may not have a lot of reserve. So I think these are some of the things, and certainly patients that have shown some regression. You know, if you do start them on a therapy and they get down to functional class 2, like Bob is saying, but then they start heading towards class 3, and we have data coming out of the REVEAL registry showing that an increase in functional class, especially along with a drop in the 6-minute walk distance by as much, maybe as little as 15%, is a very worrisome situation and a prognosis that's much worse than if you don't meet those things in as short as a year or so. So I think those are things, as I'm following patients, if I start seeing those signals, I'm usually pretty apt to jump on it quickly.
Yeah. I think that's fair. And I think in terms of barriers to therapy, we often have this concept that these therapies are so complicated with the prostanoids that we may not choose to use them. And maybe a patient is being cared for at a center that isn't really using continuous prostanoids. And so I think part of this barrier has to do with having a chronic disease management strategy that's really proactive and able to manage continuous prostanoids, or be partnered with a center that can. And so what we try to do is to reach out to the centers that are around us that may not be using continuous prostanoids and saying, okay, well, we can, you know, here's my phone number, call me up if there's an issue, we'll get the patient over here, we can start this, and you're going to have an active, vigilant program to follow their functional class, their biomarkers, their six-minute walk distance, and in that way we will catch them before they deteriorate.
I think one thing I've been impressed with our patients is how quickly it becomes routine to use prostacycline. Something that we think of as being very complicated really becomes very easy in the long run.
Aaron, can I make one more point? I think one of the things that we've appreciated in the Midwest, and I think this is around the country too, that a lot of times patients that are followed by physicians who may not be as skilled in managing with all these therapies tend to not utilize some of the things that we're talking about. And I feel like the thing that they put a lot of stock on is the echo. And even just looking at the echo, they tend to focus on the pressure and nothing else. So as a cardiologist, Bob, I'd like to hear your thoughts on if there's anything that you reliably follow on the echo to say someone may be starting to slip, especially in terms of right ventricular function. Because I do worry that even the physicians who mean well and are trying their best, they're just putting their eggs in the wrong basket and looking at one number like the pressure and saying, oh, the pressure is going down, you're heading in the right direction, when it may be because that right ventricle is just petering out.
Well, it's fair, and I think the other thing is that the availability and focus on the right heart of echocardiographers varies depending on where you are. And so you really have to be thinking about how much that right ventricle is being assessed in this echocardiogram. Sometimes I say that if I want to know one thing about an echo, don't bother to look at the heart. Just tell me if the inferior vena cava is of normal size and collapsing normally with inspiration. Because that's telling us that the right atrial pressure must be pretty normal, which we know is a very important determinant of outcome. Now, you can try to assess that on physical exam as well, and sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's more difficult. But we have other parameters we look at with the right ventricle, and I think, as you say, the pressure is the least important. It's a question of how well the right heart is handling that. Right ventricular dimensions can be used but are somewhat imprecise in many patients. I think right ventricular assessment in terms of tricuspid annular plane systolic excursion, which is just how far that tricuspid valve moves between diastole and systole, is something that's fairly easy to do and more people are doing, which is fairly useful. And severity of tricuspid regurgitation is quite simple. If the tricuspid valve is leaking a lot, you better be worried about that patient. So those are some of the parameters that I'm more interested in than just what is the pressure.
So we've now decided to put a patient on a prostacycline. The big question, I think, which is complex, especially for those people who don't do a lot of this, how do you do that? How do you initiate therapy? How do you decide when to titrate therapy? Are there gold doses that you use? And where do you involve the patient in all that?
They're really complicated questions, and we also have to be thinking about whether we're going to use a continuous parenteral prostanoid, intravenous or subcutaneous. We're going to use an inhaled prostanoid.
So where would you differentiate the patient population? Who gets an inhaled versus a continuous infusion therapy?
I think that the more advanced patient, the class 4 patient, the class 3 with pretty substantial right ventricular failure, and clinically it may be escalating diuretic requirements or slipping renal function. Mm-hmm. If you're seeing that the loop diuretic requirements are going up, that the kidney function is starting to deteriorate, those are really worrisome features that the RV is in trouble, even independent of other things that we've spoken about. So those patients, I'm likely to go with a continuous prostanoid. we don't have a lot of comparative efficacy research of inhaled prostanoids versus continuous, and so I can't say there's any head-to-head data in that regard. And maybe patients will sometimes think that they would prefer to do an inhaled therapy, but I think we have to be very cautious about that because, for me, still the gold standard for a deteriorating patient is a continuous parenteral prostanoid.
And I think one of the important limits to inhaled therapy is there's no titration. You can only get to a certain dose, and at least in my experience, there is no right dose for any one patient. There are up and down dosing, and sometimes patients run very high doses that I don't think we can ever achieve with inhaled. So if we focus on IV or sub-Q, how do you start a patient?
Well, once that decision is made, and I think, you know, and I don't know if there's any standardized way to make that decision. I think that's going to be driven by the patient and the practitioner and what they're comfortable with. But in general, with parenteral therapy, we start those patients in the hospital. Patients are started at a very low dose in order to assess the initial response. And sometimes you can see significant systemic hypotension even with a low dose of a drug like treprostinil or epoprostenol. So you have to be prepared for some hemodynamic instability, especially if they're already have a borderline blood pressure. But we start very slowly, and then typically on a day-by-day basis over the first few days, we escalate the dose as dictated by side effects. As patients tolerate some of the classic or well-known prostaglandin-mediated side effects such as headaches, flushing, diarrhea, we're able to push the dose. And once they get past the first few days and we're at a comfortable point, we'll discharge those patients. And the important thing, though, is that titration has to continue for weeks after the discharge. Many times I see patients who've been started on one of these agents by someone who's less familiar with it, and because of some side effects, they abort the titration too quickly. A simple analogy that I tell my patients is that when you're starting a prostacyclin, number one, as you said, we don't know what your ultimate dose is going to be. But I think you have to envision that you're in a car and you're at the bottom of the on-ramp to the freeway, and you have to get up that on-ramp and build up enough speed so that when you're up at the top, you're going fast enough to merge with traffic. And that may take a few weeks or several months depending on the patient. But that titration phase is driven by tolerance to side effects and down the road, how efficacious, and what I mean by that is, have we gotten that patient down into functional class two? Has the right heart failure under control? Has the BNP or the NT-proBNP come down nicely? There are multiple things that we look at, and then ultimately, we at our center still recath these people a few months to a year after initiating therapy to see that their hemodynamics are in line with everything else.
I think it's important when you look at outcome data that there's a pretty good relationship between achieving a certain dose of a prostanoid and that patient being more likely to do well over time. Mm-hmm. And patients are all different in terms of what they can tolerate, but it's clear that if you keep the dose very low, you're going to have less benefit than if you get the dose up to a certain level and reassess. And again, this is part of this chronic disease management strategy and maybe why prostanoids are underutilized, because our nurses talk to these patients often a couple of times a week, and then they're conferring with us about side effects, about how the patient is doing, and we're seeing the patient back at very regular intervals to make sure that we're meeting our treatment goals and avoiding issues also potentially overdosing in some patients is something that you've talked about previously, where sometimes if the patients aren't feeling well, we tend to increase the dose because we figure it must be because their pH is not well enough controlled. And it's well recognized that some patients actually can get into a high cardiac output state where they're having a lot of side effects of the therapy and actually would do better at a somewhat lower dose. And so potentially they will need a repeat right heart catheterization to ferret that out in terms of where are their filling pressures really and where is their cardiac index. It's really important, but if you don't get the patients up to a proper dose, they will not get the benefit of the drug.
Right. And I think, you know, just one last point about that, and you touched on this a few minutes ago, Aaron. I think that's the unique thing about advanced prostanoid therapy that none of the other therapies have. We have an ability to tailor the dose to an individual. I mean, that makes it challenging for us, and it makes us have to work harder to know that we've hit the right dose. But the point is we have a wide range and we have the flexibility to achieve a dose that can control someone's symptoms and manage their side effects. And that's lacking in some of the other, in really pretty much all the other therapies. I think we have some of that with inhaled therapy, but we hit the ceiling a lot sooner.
Right.
And as you said, I don't think we achieve the same blood levels with inhaled therapy, so we just may not be able to push the treatment as far as we'd like to. And for that reason, you know, we tend to use inhaled therapies in the less sick patients who we still think need a prostacycline, but the really sick ones, we tend to favor the parenteral therapies.
Well, it's a good point. So you have these class 3 patients where you're starting to worry about them, and they're already on an oral therapy. And they may be very good candidates for an inhaled prostanoid, where the goal is to keep the genie in the bottle in terms of the right ventricle.
Right.
And it's something that we've touched on earlier this morning when we were chatting, that there's a certain lack of catch-up in the clinical trials where patients who went into the placebo arm will eventually be able to get therapy, but they don't always seem to respond quite as well than if they got the therapy to start with. And that kind of evidence from a variety of trials makes us try to be more aggressive about, even if the patient thinks they're doing pretty well, if they're class 3 and we're seeing signs of 6-minute walk deterioration or biomarkers that aren't going the right direction or right ventricular parameters that aren't where they should be, high right atrial pressure, we need to push that patient back and try to start a little bit earlier. I think one of the barriers to prostanoid use is this idea that it's so complicated, it has so many side effects, most people aren't going to want to do it. And it's just not so. I think all of us can describe many anecdotes of patients like my kindergarten teacher who chases 30 kindergartners around every morning, and she's on a continuous prostanoid and has been for several years. She's working full-time. She has a vibrant life. And I don't think she'd be alive today if she wasn't on that drug.
Right. So I think, we've touched on a lot of important points that I think are unique features of working in a center, and that a lot of what we do is not data-driven from clinical trials. It's based on our experience and when we get together and talk about what we all do. And that gets to not only what are the goals as far as a functional class, and we always talk about functional class 2, which I don't think is satisfactory. Functional class 1 should be our goal. So in achieving that goal, you talk about titrating to a good dose of a prostacycline, balancing side effects. But when do you think about adding on other therapy to that prostacycline? And what therapy do you think is the best therapy to add on to a prostacycline?
I think assuming we at some point achieved a therapeutic place in a patient that we're happy with and comfortable with, however we want to define that, any regression from that, and I think the big things, as you mentioned, slipping in functional class, worsening hemodynamics, as Bob mentioned a few minutes ago, escalating diuretic doses, declining renal function in the wake of all this. These are the worrisome features in somebody that I think where even on a prostacycline-based therapy, you would think of adding something else. To me, the greatest weight of evidence at this point, if you want, as much as we try to practice advanced evidence-based medicine in our field, is the addition of a phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor to a patient on a prostacycline. We have the PACES trial. Granted, the dose of the phosphodiesterase 5 that was used is not a conventional dose that we use now in our country in the form of sildenafil, but there was fairly compelling data that adding a PDE5 inhibitor to patients still symptomatic on advanced prostanoid therapy, patients fared better in terms of exercise capacity and even clinical worsening. So I think that's a good combination, a prostacycline plus a PDE5 inhibitor, and that's what we tend to utilize as our next step if they're not already obviously on one.
Right. And I would say that if they're staying class 3 despite a continuous prostanoid, you should also be thinking
Absolutely.
About the possibility of lung referral for lung transplantation as well, because those patients that stay class 3 despite a good dose of a prostanoid over a substantial period, their outcome is still not all that terrific. And so you can add other therapies like a PDE5. Some people will add an endothelin antagonist, although the data for that is quite weak. But it's a little bit of a kitchen sink approach. And I think you don't want to be doing sort of Hail Mary passes when there's an option for those patients potentially to have a transplant. But I think this all gets at this point that these patients are extremely complicated. The annual mortality is still in the range of 3 to 10%, depending on what kind of patient you're talking about, and the disease tempo is quite unpredictable, and so it's very easy to get caught thinking they were okay, and they're really not. And these patients that are not coming around who are advanced class 3 despite continuous prostanoids, you need to think about lung transplant.
One other group that I think where we sometimes add a combination therapy when they're on a prostacyclin is the patient where their treatment response is not where we want it to be, and we're limited by side effects, and we're unable to escalate the dose. And I do see some patients that way. And as Bob mentioned a few minutes ago, we have a general idea of what dose range we need people to be on for a good response, and everybody's different. But there are some people who you get up to 10, 15, or 20 nanograms, and they're still class 3. And while you'd like to push the dose up, they're just having horrible side effects that even with our sort of comfort zone and protocols to manage these side effects, we just can't escalate therapy. And that's where we would think of maybe adding a second drug. And sometimes we even add a second drug and even use that to possibly lower the dose of the prostanoid a little bit for side effect management.
And I would throw in there that one thing we've learned with having options of prostanoids is sometimes switching a prostanoid will change the side effect pattern completely, and then you can escalate dose.
Sometimes it does, but at least those patients got a crack at getting a prostanoid.
Right.
And the thing that really bothers me is that a good half of patients may never get a prostanoid and may die without it. Now, if there was an active decision not to use it, that the patient was well informed, so be it. But if it's just some other barrier to use of a prostanoid, I think it's inexcusable, and I think it's something we really need to focus on, is getting the patients the opportunity to at least try a prostanoid.
And I would expect that those patients you talked about needing lung transplant, or those patients who have a less robust response to prostanoids, are those who had a long delay in getting appropriate therapy for their pulmonary hypertension.
It's often true. It's hard to back things up if they get out of hand. And I'm sometimes stunned at how quickly it can happen, where you have a patient that was doing fine, and they're in 6 months or a year later, they're much more ill, their pulmonary resistance has gone up substantially, and they've declared themselves of a very high-risk patient. And so that disease tempo is so important and so easy to lose track of it in a busy practice.
So one other thing that comes up when we're escalating these, when do you think about down titrating the medication? Is there a point where you down titrate? Is there ever a point where you would take a patient off of a prostanoid?
I think in the world we practice now, it's very rare to take someone all the way off. To me, the patient that I would consider maybe taking it off is the ones that have such a profound response that you've nearly normalized their hemodynamics, which is very hard to do in this disease. And quite honestly, the way patients get to prostacyclin therapy nowadays, which is usually means adding one or two oral therapies and then adding the prostacyclin, you don't really have that opportunity because you've probably lost it by not intervening earlier. Some of the most profound responses that we see in our clinic now are the people who started prostacyclin 10 years ago because that was all we had. So we hit the disease hard, and years of maybe reverse remodeling has gotten to this point. And we might think about that, especially if they're having complications of their prostacyclin therapy, repeated line infections, or where the side effects, again, are worse than the disease. So those are the kind of patients I would think about maybe taking them off. But again, I think it's a very rare patient. As far as decreasing the dose, I think that's something that's more commonly done, again, in this era of dual and even triple therapy. The REVEAL registry shows that somewhere about 15%, I believe, of patients are on three drugs now. And side effects can escalate as you do that. And so sometimes we have to lower the dose of prostacyclin to make the overall treatment regimen tolerable for the patient.
I think it's true. And sometimes you have patients where you feel like you've got good control of the disease with a continuous prostanoid, but they're having a lot of headaches and it's really interfering with their quality of life or requiring narcotics or something. And you may have added another agent and things look really good. They've got a walk distance of 500 meters, their BNP level is 100, and they're really a solid functional class 2, but they got bad headaches. And in that setting, I think you can down titrate and often hit an equilibrium where you maintain good prognostic control in terms of their functional parameters, but a better quality of life. And I think that that's one of the beauties about combination therapy, is being able to get the right dose of the different agents and have a better quality of life.
Right. So I think the bottom line is these are great treatments, but no cures. So we need to wrap up, and I just want to thank Bob and Murali for a good discussion about the use of prostacyclines in pulmonary hypertension. Hopefully this has been informative, and hopefully it will bring the use of prostacyclines really to the forefront of your consideration in these very complicated patients. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, Advanced Prostanoid Therapy in PAH, The Time to be Proactive is Now. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.